In key conflicts throughout world history, organized religion has all too often sided with repressive, authoritarian, and even genocidal regimes. Over and over, we've seen the church provide cover for bigotry, discrimination, violence, and even genocide. As the United States faces widespread and sustained demands for racial justice and an end to extrajudicial killings of black men in our country, the administration has jumped at the chance to politicize the protests and even escalate the violence. Ground zero for these tactics is Portland, Oregon, where despite the governor and mayor demanding federal militias, pretty much a Trump secret police, be withdrawn, the chaos continues. I am very grateful to be joined right now by the Reverend Tara Wilkins of Interfaith Clergy Resistance, who has been on the ground at the Portland protests. Reverend Tara, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
The media narrative from Portland is driven by the claims of the president and his attorney general, as well as knee-jerk law and order types. Can you tell us what it is that's really happening there?
There are many things happening parallel to one another. But the narrative that there are riots happening all over Portland is false. Activities of protesters, of peaceful protesters, are happening on two blocks in downtown Portland, and the rest of the city continues on as normal, as if nothing else were going on. So there's that first sort of idea that the setting for all of this is chaos, and that's just not factually accurate. The other piece is that, you know, what happens every night is that there are peaceful protesting happening, speakers and musicians, a diverse crowd in ages and from all walks of life who are there to say that Black Lives Matter. There's a feeling in the group of lots of love and respect. People are, you know, masking up, making sure everybody has a mask and sharing hand sanitizer. There's food and water and medical help, whatever anyone would need. And then at whatever time that the authorities decide that this is enough, they just start firing tear gas and rubber bullets into the crowd. And part of the challenge is that we have to define what we mean by violence, because their narrative is that the crowds are violent. Well, graffiti is not violence. Breaking a window is not violence. Putting your knee on somebody's neck until they stop breathing, that's violence. And so to be clear about what we are talking about what does it mean to resist? What does it mean to speak out? The other parallel thing is, while there is a lot of attention focused in the conversation on the federal presence, and there are things about that that are concerning, the practice of putting a bag over someone's head and tossing them into a van, to a protester into a van to an undisclosed location without due process, that's actually happening. But the other piece is that some of these tactics in terms of tear gas and beating protesters and being violent against protesters was actually happening by the Portland Police Department before the feds ever got there. And so our founding as the Portland Interfaith Clergy Resistance was because after the election, when people came, the last presidential election, when people came out into the streets to protest, we noticed, we observed as clergy, wow, the police are really rough on that black woman, but the white women, they're kind to, or they're at least neutral to. And so we stood up to say, you know, someone's got to say something about that and do something about that. So we've been around for a long time working on all levels to try to influence and get systemic change in how the police department handle our Black, Brown, and Indigenous citizens. So there are several things happening at once. And so we have to be careful, like the narrative about what Washington is doing here is an important narrative because it's unprecedented in my life. I'm over a certain age that we've seen tactics like this on American streets. That's alarming. And we need to deal with it one way. But I don't want us to also lose this other narrative because I don't think Portland is unlike other cities in the country, actually.
Mm-hmm. When did you first get involved in the protests?
Well, I've been involved in the protests all along. I haven't been, I've been more involved in this last month or so as things really started to escalate. So we have clergy down there every single night, and they've been down there every – we take turns. We rotate because a lot of us also have faith communities that we lead and other obligations and responsibilities. But we wear purple vests that say clergy witness on them, and we were sort of modeling after the ACLU – observers. So in the beginning, especially, but now we are reporting out. We have people on the ground who are observing what's happening and reporting out the truth of the situation, as well as providing support for protesters and just being part of the community.
What faith traditions are represented in the interfaith clergy resistance?
We have several denominations of Judaism. We have United Church of Christ, the Episcopal Church. We have United Methodist, Presbyterian Church USA. So we have some mainline Protestants. We have a couple of Buddhists. The rabbis are really strong presence here. So as I said, we have a Reconstructionist, Reform, Renewal, and Independent rabbis, and the United Church of Christ. I'm a member of the United Church of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of faith leaders in Portland who are taking the opposite position, condemning the activist and saying this kind of thing shouldn't be going on in our town?
There are some. There is division in what our tactics could be now. There are some that feel that the federal presence and our resistance to that is distracting us from the core message of the Black Lives Matter movement, which is partially why we're working so hard to make sure that that message, that we lead with that message. And, you know, I think this is a moment. Not unlike the 1960s, I think this is a moment where we need Martin, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and Malcolm X. Now, I know everybody doesn't agree on that. That's my view, that there's a place for both of those philosophies in creating change. So my perspective is that I'm not going to criticize someone else's strategy because we need all of it. We don't realize how pervasive our white supremacist culture and worldview is. And as we are awakening to that, it's really, I feel like no one person, no one perspective can hold all the things that we need right now, because it's like we've been swimming in the ocean our whole lives and we are unable to see the water. And so now we're starting to have this awakening. And so I feel like there is room for a lot of strategies, and we have to make space for different perspectives. Part of the reason that I support the protests is that nothing else is working. Like, we've done the policy work. We've done the letters. We've met with the mayor. We've met with the police commissioner. We have people that have been part of projects where the police are trying to, you know, interact with the community in different ways. And none of those things are working because they're not systemic enough. We're not doing the inner work. And again, I'm speaking about our situation here in Portland, but I don't think it's unlike other cities, other places in the country. I think it's reflective of what's going on everywhere.
Yeah, and one other question about the organization. Is this purely a local organization, or are similar groups of faith leaders coming together across denominational lines in other cities that face this federal assault?
We are not organized in that way. I don't know if there are other interfaith organizations around the country, but we are not a chapter of one. We met right after the election. There were over 100 clergy that gathered in a downtown church to lament together, to have the space to talk through, okay, what do we say to our people who are devastated by the election result? And it gave us that sort of safe space to do that. And we broke into groups around areas of main concern. And as we started to reflect on what was happening with the police, our group was the group that said, you know, we have to do something. And that then we just kept meeting and regularly meeting and strategizing and figure out where can we be the most effective. And so we already had, you know, we have a loose structure. There's no bylaws. We're not a nonprofit. We're a group of people that stay connected. And then as things have amped up in these last 60 days or so, 63, or I forget what day we're on now, we have been really organized and really, you know, people who are coming to the protests regularly are recognizing the purple vests and thanking us for being there. So we're really trying to connect with the community as well as be part of the apparatus that is pressuring public officials to make the shifts that are necessary here.
I can't help but think that you are beginning to model something that some other people in other places are going to find helpful as well. What were the protests really like before the federal paramilitary faces showed up in Portland?
They are very similar to what they are now. The difference is that there is a whole, there's more violence now. So what would happen before is when whatever that hour was that the Portland Police Department decided they wanted to clear the park, they would come over the system and say, this has been declared an unlawful assembly. Please disperse or risk arrest or munitions, something like that. And then, of course, nobody moved. And then they would start. Well, that had degraded to the place where they quit making that announcement. And whatever that time was that they thought we should disperse, they would just fling open the doors and start firing into the crowd. And I personally witnessed that. It isn't just the reports of our people. And that's one of the valuable things about having not just our clergy on the front lines, but there's a whole host of independent journalists that are documenting by video every night what's really happening. What the federal presence is adding is they're abducting people, and one officer sexually assaulted one of the lawyers that was in part of the Wall of Moms that was there one night. They're more brutal than even the Portland Police Department, and it, you know, white or black or Latinx or indigenous, it doesn't matter. They're pretty much a violent force. And, you know, my concern about them, among many concerns, is that they're not accountable to anybody. Not that we had a great situation with the Portland police, But they have, their presence has taken it to another level. And I can tell you, Portland is not going to back down. You know, this is an activist community. There are over something like 12,000 nonprofits in the state of Oregon. They're seasoned activists. They know how to help create change. And there's a resolve there. I could really feel that last night. There's a resilience and a resolve to staying the course. And so where does this head? You know, where does this go? How many people have to die and be beaten before the public officials make change? And we can't say that change is impossible. We changed the entire way we grocery shop on a dime. Don't tell me we can't make these changes. It's a choice at this point. And so I don't know what we have to do to get public officials to make the choice to do this differently. But we're going to be there until they do.
What can you tell us about the other groups taking part in Portland? We've heard reports about the Wall of Moms, Wall of Dads, Wall of Vets. What are these other groups like?
Well, it's interesting to me because in one respect, some of these groups probably wouldn't be in the same room if we don't necessarily naturally interact if it weren't for standing for this common cause. And I think that so there are all different kinds of groups and people there, and there isn't like a centralized power structure to what it means to protest. So we have artists there. There's been a group coming, kind of a marching band. There's a trumpet player and a drummer, and they provide a lot of music. The feel of the protest is much like kind of a festival or some kind of family kind of gathering. There are people selling t-shirts, Black Lives Matter t-shirts. There's free food. There's a camaraderie amongst the groups. So they come from all walks of life. There are a lot of young people there. There's a youth collective. There's Portland Resistance. There's a bunch of other smaller organizations that are there and present. And then, you know, groups like the Wall of Moms and other groups get sort of the media hit for what they represent. But there's all different walks of life there. It's really kind of beautiful in that way.
I want to ask you if you would to share with our listeners the kind of abuse that's taking place here in the United States for people doing what the First Amendment to the Constitution says we can do.
So in addition to inflicting military-grade tear gas, some of the tear gas that the Portland police use would be banned by the Geneva Convention if we were part of that in the same way. So you have these chemicals that are being flung every single night to the point of disturbing the neighbors. There's a lawsuit from the apartment building near downtown. The gas was getting into the jail, which is next door at the Multnomah County Justice Center, and prisoners there were experiencing the tear gas in the ventilation system. So massive amounts of tear gas. But also they're intimidating by, I don't know if you've seen some of the pictures of the rubber bullets right between the eyes. They're targeting people. I mean, I feel that's kind of like symbolic of assassination, right? They wouldn't have to choose the face. They don't have to choose. I mean, if you're looking at a deterrent, there's other ways to do that. You don't have to do between the eyes. That's, you know, it fractured people's skulls. Some people are losing vision. And it's not just a single case. Like, it's happening over and over. Then when they come out from behind the fence, when they're in the streets, they are physically violent. So they grab people and throw them on the ground. They beat them with their baton. You know, of course, they're their words are very violent in terms of the things they say to people. They're not trained in crowd control. This isn't come out and de-escalate and get people to disperse. They're coming out as if it's the beach of Normandy with their weapons drawn. And I worry that somebody's going to die, that they're going to use live ammunition. There's a lot of rumors about the federal agents having live ammunition, that they're not just using rubber bullets and tear gas. So, you know, what is the end point? Because right now, you know, shaking a fence is not violence. Shooting off fireworks is not violence. Even starting a fire, you know, they've started sometimes somebody will start a small fire like in the street or whatever. They'll light cardboard on fire or something. You know, that is not a violent act. And what we need from our police departments all across the country is techniques in de-escalation, in hearing the outcries. You know, our Black and Brown and Indigenous citizens do not feel safe in our community. They're targeted in the grocery store. They're targeted on the streets. And, you know, I'm angry about that. I can't imagine what it would feel like to be discriminated against just because of how I look. I have faced some of my own discrimination in life, but it's not the same as what people of color go through.
The Reverend Tara Wilkins is pastor of the Bridgeport United Church of Christ in Portland. She is a fierce advocate and justice warrior, proclaiming an inclusive gospel that honors the many paths to God, and has been on the front lines in Portland with other members of interfaith clergy resistance. Reverend Tara, I hope you keep safe as you continue this ministry, and I really want to thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. I'm happy and glad to be able to tell the story.